Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Rabona podcast. I'm joined again by Michael De Silva. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
Welcome back from your travels, Gulliver's travels.
Yeah.
And Ryan Hun.
Hello,
hello, Ryan.
Hello.
And this week we are discussing primarily the wonder of the wide forward. So many fantastic performances from players playing in the inside left, inside right positions across Europe this week. So we thought we'd start with what they've been up to.
We're going to start with Sancho Corner.
We have to.
Yeah,
what a goal.
Welcome to the Sancho podcast.
Oh, that was such a nice goal. And Musa, you compared it quite rightly to Roberto Baggio. We're talking about, by the way, Sancho's winning goal against Schalke in the Ruhr derby. I think he's the youngest player to score
the winner
in that game. Yeah,
let me give credit to, I think it was Grace Note Live on Twitter who tweeted this. He's the youngest ever goal scorer from Dortmund in that derby. I think he's still 18, isn't he?
Yeah, he is, yeah.
And the goal, the reason I compared it to Roberto Baggio is there's a goal, I think it was 2-0. Italy beat the Czech Republic 2-0, I think, or 2-1.
Italian 90.
And Baggio basically made his sort of announcement to the world. He plays a 1-2. I'm not sure it was Giuseppe Giannini, I'm not sure, but he plays a 1-2. Like, he starts out wide on the left and then he continues the run into the box. Bamboozles a defender and puts
it's a carbon copy.
Yeah, and this was it about Sancho. I didn't quite appreciate, because I didn't see the game live. I saw just the finish from Sancho, but watching it again, he picks the ball up really wide and really deep, and he still has so much to do. You don't think that this is a goal-scoring opportunity.
Right.
But he picks out the pass, and as you say, continues that run. He expects the ball back.
Yeah.
And he's demanding high quality of his teammates. He's raising the whole standard of that Dortmund team at the moment. The finish was so instinctive. It was just, it was beautiful.
He's the Luka Doncic of the Bundesliga.
Boom.
I'm going to throw that out there.
I like that. Only Doncic, I would say, Doncic is basically being amazing for the Mavericks right now, Dallas Mavericks, I still think he's a pass-first player. And what I love about Sancho is, he's a great creator, but he's ruthless and he attacks space. And you mentioned, you compared him to Thierry Henry, and I think the comparison's fair in the sense, not only in which he peels away to the left, but the way that he finds space in unconventional areas.
The reason I mentioned the Henry thing is because, you know, it's a big, big derby, that derby. I don't think it maybe gets the attention it deserves outside of Germany when it's on. Mm. It's a massive, massive game in the Bundesliga. And to find yourself in that position at that age,
right?
It's just like he's done it a million times. When you knew Henry would get into that pocket,
it's
just like, this is the only one way this is going to go. For a kid that age to finish so calmly in that situation is just amazing.
Mm. Well, it's after the week he'd been through as well.
Yeah, I mean, like people who follow him on social media probably would have saw it, but you know, his grandmother passed away and he dedicated the goal to her afterwards and stuff.
He hadn't trained as well for a couple of days. He went to London and came back. I think he had one final session on Friday before the game.
Yeah, and I want to say as well about Jadon Sancho, it's fascinating because he's unfortunate in that he's probably behind three of the best wide forwards in world football. Raheem Sterling at City. You had Mahrez, who was signed in the summer. Bernardo Silva actually can play there. I wasn't including him, but he can play there. And Leroy Sané, of course, as well. So three or four of the best sort of wide forwards in this role, wingers, inside players. And what I love about this role, the evolving role of the wide forward, we see, you know, obviously a Manchester United, Anthony Martial, doing the same kind of thing. This ability to find pockets of space on the edge of the area and to go inside or outside. But the thing with these players now is they finish with such consistency. You know, wingers of the old days, like Paolo Futre, they might score like, you know, don't know the sort of strike rate.
Second mention of Futre on the podcast well, this season.
It's great to have him back.
Only because Paolo Futre was an explosive dribbler who was a game breaker, but wasn't necessarily expected to finish. But these wingers now, they finish.
But you talk about the evolving role of the winger, the wide forward, but it's also, yeah, it's the prominence, the increasing prominence of the wide forward instead of a striker. I mean, if you look at Liverpool this weekend, Chelsea, Tottenham, City, none of them started with a recognised striker. Teams are now using a false nine as their go-to, their plan A. It was always kind of a plan B or like an experiment. And I think it's probably a reaction to, I think it's a reaction to the high press that we're seeing so many coaches implement and the need for, I mean, of course, if you have a Kane or a Lewandowski, you know, you're going to play him, but a lot of teams don't have that dominant striker. Mm. So to have three smaller, more versatile, more defensively minded forwards seems to be the way that a lot of coaches are going.
There was an amazing moment in the Chelsea City game where Sané got caught offside a couple of times. And on the replays, it was really, it gave you like a really good overview of Pep's kind of like system. Mm. And by far and away, the two highest people on the pitch was Sané on the left, Sterling on the right, and they were on the touchline.
Yeah.
Right.
And they were the highest City players. And they were literally not dropping a couple of yards off to, like, you know, make sure they're not offside. They were on the last defenders.
Mm. That's Pep Guardiola. I mean, he is the absolute master at stretching the play and expanding the dimensions of the pitch. I mean, I think you compared it to floor spacing before in the NBA, you know, when you like stretch the floor for the shooters. And you see a parallel. You go to watch Barcelona and it's fascinating when you see the centre-backs. They are as far apart as you could possibly imagine. The centre-backs often, when Barcelona are playing out in the back, will be almost on the touchline like wingers, and the full-backs are pushed up to the halfway line. Mm. So you've got this incredible expansion of dimensions.
And the defensive midfield, whoever that is, will drop in and form, you know, the as last line of defence. Yeah.
And there's that amazing bit in Take the Ball, Pass the Ball, where Victor Valdez sits down with Pep on, and Pep just starts coaching. He says, right, this is where I want the centre-backs to be. And he's just like, he's crazy. I just thought he was crazy. Like, why are you doing this?
But I love that Valdez was into it because Valdez is also a bit crazy as well.
Yeah.
I was like, you see Valdez going, this is crazy.
I'm crazy.
I like it.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah,
exactly.
But one thing I want to mention as well about these systems and spacing the game out, because, you know, wide forwards are obviously part of a system of stretching the play, being offensive. And this is why I want to mention Frankie de Jong at Ajax, because they're looking at him. They're looking at bringing Frankie de Jong into the midfielder at Ajax. Mm-hmm. Barca are looking at him. And the reason why I think, one of the reasons I think they're interested in him is because he has this incredible ability, as Iniesta did, to receive the ball anywhere in the defensive third under pressure.
Sorry to interrupt. Yeah. He is genuinely amazing.
He's extraordinary.
Yeah, he's very,
unbelievable,
very good.
Frankie de Jong.
The reason I mention him, and I know that we're talking about wide forwards, is because they're all part of the same system. So you have the wide forwards pressing really high up, right? And the only thing that allows you the freedom to push Sterling and Sané so high up is knowing that you've got a player who will retain the ball under any kind of pressure. So it could be Modric at Madrid or Busquets at Barcelona. But if Frankie de Jong, whoever gets Frankie de Jong, I think he's that important of a signing, enables the most incredible attacking play, because I've seen this guy receive the ball under pressure, edge of his box, two men on him, and he will beat them, no problem, then play the ball into feet through the middle of the pitch on a diagonal into the feet of a midfielder. That is an astonishing quality, which is actually really underrated in football, I think, still.
A little bit of a tangent about De Jong, but he has this amazing pass that he tends to do, which I don't really see anyone else do. It's almost like he kind of passes the ball on the move, the step before you expect him to plant his foot and pass it.
In stride.
He always passes it with the outside of his foot.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's this amazing thing that he does, and he does it all the time. And it always catches people off.
I call it smuggling. I know what you mean. It's Redondo did it. Smuggling, yeah, Redondo did it. Redondo in the Champions
Redondo,
League final.
Redondo, Futre.
Moose is pulling all the names
the
out of
the Champions
hat.
League final, I have to stand, I will die on this hill. Fernando Redondo was the best at this pass I've ever seen. Like,
sorry, he's on Redondo. We might as well just go. This podcast is done.
This could take
a while. Strike me down if I tell a lie. Fernando Redondo in the 2000 UEFA Champions League final against Valencia, gave this astonishing performance where he shifted the ball so many times between, I think, Albelda and Baraja, the centre midfielders for Valencia. This 10, 15-yard pass on the run with the head down and would just punch it through the line. And this, De Jong is the master, the modern master. Kroos, to an extent before, could do that when he was slightly more advanced. Modric as well, at his best, can do this.
Do you know who was really good at that as well, actually, was Fabregas. When Fabregas first started coming through and playing in, like, alongside Gilberto at Arsenal, you know, you're seeing a kid come through like that. I mean, he was 16 at the time. Yeah. His technical ability really stood out. And that's the same thing about De Jong. And that's really hard to do now because the technical level of most midfields is just through the roof compared to what it used to be. You know, we should caveat it with the fact that, you know, the Eredivisie isn't the strongest league around. But still, you know, he's done it in the Champions League. He's done it for Holland.
Right, and resurgent Holland, yeah.
And I've not been that excited about a central midfielder for a while, I don't think.
Do you know what I like about him is that he's an architect. Like, he's building, you know, we used to play football and be like, oh, you know, you play always forward. But then there are some players like that. There's a famous goal that Barcelona scored in the Champions League, I think 2001, when they beat Liverpool 3-1 and Overmars scores the goal. And it's like a 2-minute build up. The amount of times the ball goes back and across to create space and gaps and just breaks down, you know, breaks down the opposition. And you see Dembele doing it now, you know, more and more so in this sort of, as he's more integrated into the Barca side. Against Espanyol, the 4-0 win, Messi was obviously transcendent. But what was interesting was the way that Dembele was playing.
Yeah.
He was playing the ball back with so much more patience and creating space by just, you know, charging into space, get the ball high up. It's almost like in rugby when you kick for touch, like getting into space, getting high up the pitch and then retain possession, knocks it back, stretches the play.
And, you know, why do you need a out-and-out striker when you've got someone like Dembele who does all those things you've just said, but then can also finish in the way he did against Espanyol?
Exactly.
That was an amazing goal.
The way the ball was on its way down before it went up, like, it was so flat.
The dip,
you know?
On it, yeah.
It was really nice.
I mean, I must say about Dembele, as I want to say about sort of the general configuration of the front three, which you see, they're unmarkable. When you've got a front three and you don't know who the pivot is,
yeah,
then you're in real trouble.
This is a nightmare to defend against.
And then when you've got players like Jerdan Shaqiri who can come in at Liverpool and continue where Mane has left off,
right,
it's really hard to see how they're going to get beaten this season. And, you know, I think Liverpool, I think it's the first time they've been top since early October.
They're unbeaten.
The only unbeaten team in the Premier League.
What's remarkable about them is they still have an extra gear and a half.
Yeah.
Like, Naby Keita is, you know, he's had some injury trouble. And he's not, to me, he's still, I would say, like a 7.5 and an 8 in terms of what he can do, in terms of his ceiling. And the beauty of Liverpool this year is they're almost like the evolution of the Spurs side a couple of years ago. Remember when Spurs had the most perfectly balanced attack and defence, but didn't quite have the extra squad depth?
Yeah.
And Liverpool are basically their Spurs with squad depth.
Yeah, it's a good shout, yeah.
And I love that. I love how they just have, you know, the team spirit of Salah saying afterwards, I'm not taking the man of the match award, it's Milner that deserves it.
Yeah.
You know, they really fight for each other.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got squad players that can come in like Lallana and come in and play. I mean, the ball he played for Salah's final goal was a beauty.
Yeah, I mean, Liverpool haven't necessarily been blowing teams away this season. Of course, they did at Bournemouth and they have once or twice. But, you know, they were so reliant on Salah last season for, you know, how many goals did he score in the end?
Goodness, 44, 45, something like that.
And he hasn't quite clicked in the same way so far. But, you know, Firmino is just stepping up. I absolutely love him. He's and when we talk about wide forwards, I mean, he's someone who's just assumed this kind of false nine position and he defends like a defensive midfielder.
Right.
But he does it so high up the pitch.
Can I be a bit of a hipster here? Do you remember Daniele Massaro at Milan?
There we go. There's the hat trick.
Bit of a hipster reference, but Massaro.
It's like Musa Bingo.
Hardworking forward who's, Firmino's primary responsibility is defensive. It's winning the ball back high up. Yeah. And Massaro did that for Milan so well, chipped him with a couple of goals in important games. But his real job was to liberate the runners off him, like Savicevic, who are the kind of magicians in that team. And what I love about Firmino is, yeah, he gets criticised because he's not scoring the most goals. But one of the reasons, if you're constantly defending and pushing and pressing and stretching the play, then actually, and I said this before, like attacking is almost your kind of third responsibility, like actually scoring goals. Your primary responsibility is winning the ball back. Mm-hmm. Secondary is assists. And the third is probably scoring.
And anyone who judges Firmino on the number of goals he scores fundamentally misunderstands the contribution he makes to that team.
I think this is the thing with football, though. Football's changing to a point where you can't have one set of elite skills. It's not enough anymore just to be an elite finisher.
And that even goes for goalkeepers.
Yeah, definitely. Goalkeepers. And you've seen how that's revolutionised football.
Yep.
It's the same with forwards. You know, you have to be, you know, some of the best finishers in the Premier League are the wide forwards. Mm. Right. You know, some strikers don't score as many goals because they have a changing role in order to allow these wide forwards to kind of bloom.
Raheem Sterling is probably, you know, he's been on incredible form this season, just like he was last season. Goals, assists, we see the best of him. And then he has to put up with the abuse that he received. What are your thoughts on what we saw?
Well, I mean, the first thing before I get into what Sterling experienced at Stamford Bridge, because we, you know, it's, you don't want to dignify it with comment, but I think it's worth coming out and say something about it. Before I get into Sterling, I want to talk quickly about Guardiola, just at City and what he's done, because it's funny, we talk a lot about Guardiola following Cruyff's legacy, but we don't give Guardiola enough credit for his reverence for the concept of the total footballer, which I've written about in an upcoming piece for Bonner.
Mm-hmm. Plug.
Well, absolutely, because, you know, Guardiola comes in and he is absolutely, you know, he loves the total football, the player that can play four or five positions. And what I love about what he's done with Sterling is he's turned Sterling into this perfect hybrid of the winger, the centre forward, you know, the sort of inside forward, the playmaker, which is glorious to see. But in terms of how I feel about the race thing and Sterling, I'm glad he came out and said it. I'm glad he came out and connected the abuse he gets on the pitch with what the media is saying about him. I'm so glad he said it. I'm so sad that, in fact, he was actually talking about somebody else, wasn't he? Tosin Adebayo. That's the irony. He was actually referring to someone else.
Yeah.
But I love that he came out and did that on behalf of somebody else.
Yeah.
And I think that what's very powerful is that this England team is beloved because of the way it conducts itself. It's kind of a footballing version of the Olympics 2012 opening ceremony, which was like this multicultural delight that everyone could love, regardless of how they voted, what their background was. And the fact that Sterling is the emblem of that team and he's being attacked, I think the Daily Mail's gone too far with this one. I don't think it's ready for...
And they're not alone, by the way.
The backlash, right, yeah.
It's not just the Daily Mail.
The Daily Mail not alone. It's The Sun. It's all manner of papers. It's some football writers as well. The way they describe black players, you know, it's all part of the same architecture of racial ignorance / bigotry / racism. It's all part of the same cocktail. Mm. But there's been some great commentary. And the great thing is that the usual suspects who've been really good on this issue before, like Daniel Story at Football 365, are now providing some of the most nuanced commentary. So I'm really happy to see this getting aired properly.
It's surprising and commendable that Sterling has been able to keep his cool for so long, like with what he's had to put up with. You know, we look at the whole tattoo situation in the summer, it's ridiculous. And lesser personalities would have cracked and would have
Are you referring to when the Daily Mail wrote a column about his tattoo? Or they?
Yeah, I can't remember
Probably
who it was.
Publication. One of them.
One of them. It might have been The Sun, actually. But yeah, you know, he's under incredible scrutiny, as all players are. And, you know, someone like Sterling, He doesn't need this. Any young black player trying to make their way has it harder than most of their white counterparts. And this is not how we as a nation should be treating our young footballers, our young sportsmen, our young people.
Right. Yeah, I think that's completely right. And it's a bit depressing that, again, Sterling had to come out and say something. And while I am very glad that Sterling's been so stoic under pressure, I kind of get a bit worried with that analysis, not yours, but just the general overview that, because this idea of being dignified and reasonable in the face of abuse, it almost puts a lot of pressure on the person, on the victim, on the sufferer. It's almost like there's a good victim, like a type of person that should be fine with it. And actually, the problem is sometimes when you stay silent for so long, it normalizes the abuse.
Yeah.
I don't even mean the player, I mean those people around you, because it's not even Sterling's fault. When people around Sterling, and I point the finger at his club and the wider footballing community, the Premier League and other newspapers, other journalists, when the people around Sterling witness what's happening, don't say anything. So it's then Sterling that has to start this debate. Like he literally was like, I've got to speak out, otherwise nothing happens.
Yeah.
That's appalling. Yeah. The person suffering the abuse should never be the face of the movement to get rid of the abuse.
We've had this conversation a number of times away from the podcast. For example, was it last year when we were watching that Bayern game? We weren't watching it together, but there was a commentator who said something, who was talking about Hummels and Boateng.
Yeah.
And this is the thing that we reference quite a lot, even though it's the most visibly shocking, like an older white guy in the front row of Stamford Bridge screaming, like foaming at the mouth at someone like Raheem Sterling.
Mm.
It's the more subtle elements that really need to be challenged and pulled up on. Because, for example, the guy was talking about Hummels and Boateng, saying Hummels is the, you know, the technical ball playing centre back, and Boateng is the pace and the power, you know. And it took me 5 seconds to pull up the game stats, and it was just Boateng's passing stats were just off the charts,
off the scale,
compared to to Hummels. So it's like this, the way that.
It's so lazy, isn't it?
It's not just the foaming at the mouth, rabid kind of like white fan. It's the more subtle descriptions of how they are commented on around football. And
yes.
I think that, you know, Piers Morgan's a prime example. I don't really want to talk about the guy on the podcast, but the first thing that he goes after yesterday when this point is raised is like he wants to debate another middle-aged white guy on Breakfast TV about this problem. As opposed to just listening to the people who are experiencing it, you know, because it has to make people like Piers Morgan and us and anyone face up to stuff that we might not have thought about before.
I think actually it's good that we mentioned Piers Morgan, because I think he's extremely dangerous. And the reason I say he's dangerous is because when everyone else is watching the Olympics opening ceremony, the Olympics opening ceremony, and everyone was loving it and enjoying this kind of diversity, this multicultural festival, Piers Morgan goes on Twitter and says, I think we should have another British Empire. Now, to have that reaction, to celebrate a racist colonial project at that time shows where your head is at. If you are looking at a group of people, multicultural group of people, and your first instinct is to tweet, we need to go and castrate people with pliers again. We need to go and subjugate the vast majority of the world, like non-white people. If that is your instinctive response, that shows where your head is at. That shows how you watch everything when we're discussing racism. If that is your prism for analyzing racial problems, you shouldn't be taken seriously. And the reason why I think he's dangerous is because he has this immense reach.
Yeah.
You know, we can't just ignore him, because that doesn't work. Yeah. It didn't work with Katie Hopkins. It won't work with him.
It's people like him that they're obsessed with fighting this imaginary fight instead of fighting the real problems.
Mm.
Like Piers Morgan could be like, right, I haven't seen this because I don't experience this on a day-to-day basis. I'm not excusing that, but you can understand slightly why a well-to-do, middle-class, middle-aged white guy might not understand the microaggressions that people who aren't straight white dudes experience on a daily basis.
Mm.
But if he was obsessed with listening and fighting that kind of injustice,
what's
with
really
his reach,
yeah,
as opposed to this like weird imaginary, like there's an attack on like masculinity, or there's an attack on white people, or I can't say this anymore because of the PC brigade. It's like it's like clockwork. His tactic is like clockwork.
Right.
Say something outrageous in response to something like the Sterling thing. Wait for the backlash. That plays into his hands. It's like, criticize this Twitter mob.
Mm.
And then it's the PC brigade's gone mad. You can't say anything.
It's formulaic.
Yeah.
It's formulaic.
Like, and frankly, it's bullshit.
Yeah.
I'm really glad that this conversation is being had now, but it blows my mind that it's taken something like Raheem Sterling, who, by the way, just the way that he opened up that debate was clinical, subtle, and really, really, really classy.
Yeah. And look who has supported it. You know?
Exactly. But he shouldn't have to do that. A 23-year-old footballer should not have
to
do that.
He's literally busy. It's hard enough being a world-class footballer week in, week out. He's literally doing that and everything else on top of it. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah, sorry for sounding a bit ranty, but
just why I raised who has supported it on social media. It's every single English black player who's ever had to put up with this, you know? Everyone.
And I feel like I have to say this as well. Like, you know, we can debate, you know, look at Piers Morgan's reaction to all of this and like whether he's racist, whether he's not. I can just say this to quote Kanye West when he was still making great music. Piers Morgan doesn't like black people. He doesn't like black people. He may have the odd black friend, but he doesn't like black people because this is part of a pattern with what Piers Morgan does. Mm. He is always the first to antagonize. And like you said, if you genuinely care, if a community of people are going, this is a genuine problem, and your first instinct is to double down and be defensive, you don't care.
Yeah.
And he can't pretend for a second that he cares.
We've spoken about it before. A lot of straight white people get equality mixed up with quote unquote white repression.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Because it's like they think that their rights are being challenged just because everyone else is going to be entitled to the same stuff that they've been entitled to for years.
Yeah.
It's like, where in your head is this a problem?
I actually get it. To be honest, I do always get it because if you are the kind of complacent person who goes, racially complacent person or racist who turns up and abuses Raheem Sterling at a football match, you're doing that because you understand how much you have to lose. Because you've been mediocre, you've been coasting for so long on unearned privilege, and all of a sudden, the second they've opened up the race, it's like almost, let's say you've never trained for the 100 meters, and because you're the only people ever allowed to run, you win every week. And then all of a sudden, you open up to everyone. And all these people who've been training for years, have been doing weights, who've been doing all, you know, like studying like how to sprint, how to decelerate, whatever, they come and compete against you. Mm. You're terrified because you're like, it is actually oppression from your perspective because you are coasting and all of a sudden you've actually got to work for your place in the society. And that is terrifying to a lot of people. I've mentioned this before on Twitter, like I've called it the black reaction is on trial. And Sterling, like the black reaction is on trial. Like, how's he going to respond? Is he going to do this? Is he going to do that? Is he going to be abusive back? Is he going to, John Barnes backheeled the banana off the pitch. And no, that's not a normal. That's not normal. Like the only reason these footballers are so calm is because if they responded to everything, they'd explode.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's the only reason. Not because they're these super dignified Morgan Freeman type. No, they're not. They're human beings who've got to get on with. In the same way that a woman who walks from the front door to the train station can't respond to every wolf whistle, every grope, every whatever, because if she did that, she wouldn't get to work.
Yeah.
So these women aren't dignified. They're not special. They're human. They're deeply human. And this is what is frightening. Mm. We have created a situation where the abuse is so normalized that we're spending more time applauding the dignity of the victim rather than the fury of the perpetrator.
Whereas in reality, Raheem Sterling is well within his rights, and not Raheem Sterling, everyone.
Yeah.
You know, to go absolutely
nuclear.
Crazy.
That's actually more normal. Right. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. It's not normal. And why are we applauding people to essentially like, oh, well done, you didn't go crazy to something that absolutely deserves going crazy. Like if that happened in the street, right? And Raheem Sterling turned around and decked that guy, you would have been like, well, yeah.
Well, it literally did happen in the street. So last year, a Manchester United, I don't know when they were when he was jailed, but the sentence was handed down quite recently, I think. He was jailed for 4 months for attacking Raheem Sterling in the car park. He kicked him several times in the legs. I mean, and then he also said,
I didn't hear about this.
Yeah, yeah. He said, I hope
outside
your mother.
Outside the Man City training ground.
I hope your mother. I hope your
child and your mother.
I hope your child and your mother drop dead.
Yeah,
you
N-word. Die. Yeah.
Called him the N-word. I hope they die.
And he was waiting. He basically pulled up next to him as Sterling was waiting to go into the City training ground.
Let me throw this as well. I deliberately did not write anything about Sterling or much about him until late last night because I wanted other people to discuss it first. Because there is this pattern of what does the black person have to say about it? Look, if a woman has been harassed in the street, why should the woman then deconstruct what she went through in order for there to be a solution? She's already dealing with the trauma of the harassment.
Yeah.
This is the job of men, like for us to get involved. And I thought, I want to see what analysis comes from white people who've seen this. Mm. And thankfully, I can say I saw a lot of very good analysis. There was some bad stuff, but the voices I expected to come through and deliver, Henry Winter, Daniel Story, they delivered. And I'm very, very glad to be associated with them as part of the writing community. There was some other bad stuff, but I'm glad that we got the analysis out there in that form.
I agree.
Okay, so we're back from the break and back to the football. And Ralf Hasenhüttl has been appointed Southampton coach. What do you make of that, guys?
He's got a hell of a job on his hands.
Well, having seen Southampton play last week at Wembley, which, by the way, was a eerily quiet atmosphere, can't wait till we get out of there. It was, you're right. He's got a real job on his hands. I think I think he's got the tools there to turn Southampton. Well, I mean, obviously he just has to save them this year, but they could become something really exciting under him. They've got, like, you know, the likes of Nathan Redmond, who I think is hasn't fulfilled his potential since joining Southampton, certainly under Mark Hughes, he stalled. But they've got some other players as well that I think could really make something happen. But, you know, he's nicknamed the Klopp of the Alps,
which I dislike that nickname, by the way.
It's strange, you know, isn't it? I hadn't even heard that one in Germany.
Well, it's probably in English. They've just made it up.
Yeah. You know what I mean? But there are some similarities to their outlook, but Hasenhüttl, I think, could bring back the good times. And as you wrote in your piece for rabonamag.com,
plug.
Yeah, it does have echoes of those appointments before, the, you know, when Southampton had that clear philosophy, that clear vision, you know, Pochettino and then Koeman. I had to read your piece to remind myself that they had finished sixth under Koeman.
Yeah, they had a really good period where the first season they were back up in the Premier League, and Poch took over in January. I think they finished 14th that year.
Yeah.
Finished 8th the next season.
Yeah.
Then Poch left for Spurs, and then Koeman finished 7th, which was their highest Premier League position at the time, and then beat it the next season.
And then a Southampton fan, I remember at the time, the first season after Pochettino left, said to me, yeah, he was holding us back.
The problem that Ralph has got is that the squad isn't as good as it was under Pochettino or Koeman, and Paul Mitchell's not there, who was head of recruitment at Saints, moved to Spurs shortly after Pochettino went as well. There's rumours that he might be coming back. If he does go back to Southampton, then that makes the Hasenhüttl appointment even better, in my opinion, because I think those two teaming up will be really impressive.
Yeah, I think
But in the meantime, I think that the thing that's so good about Ralph Hasenhüttl is that he's going to make that squad better. And there are fundamental things that he will do to that squad that will make them improve.
Well, we've been watching Leipzig for the last couple of years, and under Hasenhüttl, they were... they've gone now to a more kind of defensive outlook, but they were, it was always attack first, you know.
They were relentless.
But as Hasenhüttl raised in the press conference at his unveiling, that took time, you know. He had to perfect that over a couple of years. And at Southampton, you know, with the greatest respect, they just have to stay in that league.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't think they'll go down now. I don't think they'll go down this season, because I think...
Too good to go down.
It's not that. I just think that, like, basically, it's going to take a couple of months, but they're going to start getting fitter.
Yeah.
And as soon as they start getting fitter, players like Redmond will dramatically improve, I think. And Ralph Hasenhüttl teams can be quite relentless. And the thing that's really good about it as well is that you're not taking a guy who's just managed at the top level... into a team that's struggling in the relegation zone. He has a proven track record of taking teams up, keeping teams up, and massively improving teams. Everywhere he's been, he's either been promoted or kept them up.
Yeah.
You know, he took Ingolstadt into the Bundesliga for the first time in their relatively short history, and they've since gone down.
And Pascal Gross was a big part of Ingolstadt under Hasenhüttl. I wouldn't be surprised, as he doesn't quite seem to fit in at Brighton anymore, that he makes that move over to Southampton. But it's going to be those kind of signings.
I think there's going to be maybe some interesting loan moves, maybe in January. I don't think they're going to sign anyone in January. I think you might see a few loan moves.
Well, he has been told by the Southampton board that he's got money to spend in January if he needs it. But Hasenhüttl himself said that he's going to need the time between now and then just to assess who's up to the challenge in his current squad. But it was interesting to see that, his technique is that, I need these guys to work harder for me.
Yeah.
And that's in training sessions. And, you know, he now has a week between the defeat at Cardiff, which would have been disappointing for him, even though he had one training session before to prepare them. But between now and the Arsenal game on the weekend, he's got a week. And it's really, I mean, I'm expecting to see an improved Southampton take on Arsenal. Obviously, you're not expecting the world, but at least he's going to have a little bit of time to implement his methods. And it's going to be good to see that.
I just love the quality of the coaching in the Premier League now. It's off the scale. You look at Everton, Watford tonight, two fantastic managers.
Yeah.
You look at West Ham, who are clawing their way back towards safety with Pellegrini.
Who thought, you know, it's almost like Manuel Pellegrini's a good manager.
I mean, who knew?
Who knew?
Felipe Anderson is doing big things. Chicharito is Chicharito, you know, just the predator from short range. But what I love is you're seeing managers getting the best out of players, their preferred positions. And it's just a triumph of coaching this year in the Premier League. Like, you look at the top teams, and they're there because they're just superbly coached. Who else but Klopp could live with this era of Guardiola? But they're going toe to toe.
Even that, I mean, you know, I'm not sure if how many times they've played each other before, but that's the first time Sarri's beaten Guardiola on the weekend. Klopp has taken like a record-breaking Liverpool season, and they're only a couple of points clear.
Yeah. Tottenham have had their best start to a Premier League season ever, and they're 6 points off the top.
You know, Arsenal are still a little bit confusing, but you've seen massive improvements under Emery.
When's the last time
start of the season? Right,
It was Chelsea away.
Goodness,
21 unbeaten now. But do you know what? As an Arsenal fan, bringing it back round to Southampton, I'm a little bit worried. I would have loved to have played Southampton a couple of weeks ago as opposed to now. Because if anything's got like, look how much Hasenhüttl has changed the Southampton side. It's playing an Arsenal side that are without their first choice three centre backs next weekend. Holding's injured, out for the season with a cruciate ligament injury. Socrates is suspended, and Mustafi was suspended anyway before he went off
injured. Could we see Koscielny finally?
I think it will be a Koscielny-Monreal back centre-back pairing. I don't think they'll play three at the back.
Is it away at...
It's away at Southampton.
Oh, no, that's horrible.
It's a tricky one.
Historically,
nice
somewhere
place.
Arsenal have not been very good at St Mary's.
Yeah, and you talk about the quality of coaching. I mean, Hasenhüttl...
brilliant.
He was pushing Bayern, you know, just 2 years ago. At the top of the Bundesliga, they were in the Champions League, Leipzig, and he's now taken over a team that are struggling to stay up.
Do you remember a few weeks ago we were talking about Manchester United and we were saying, I wonder if they'd give someone like Hasenhüttl a chance.
Yeah.
I think the thing I wrote in the piece was like, if there is a downside to this appointment for Southampton fans, history suggests he won't stick around too long. But he's only signed a 2.5-year deal anyway, I think. I don't think Southampton fans will really mind if it shifts the needle back into the direction where they were. And I could see him really succeeding at Southampton and then being like Man United manager.
I was just about to say the same thing. It has that Koeman Pochettino appointment all over it.
Yeah. Even though they lost at the weekend, and I know they're a little bit worried, I have to shout out one of my best mates, Rob. He's a Southampton fan and he's stressing a little bit at the moment.
I think they'll be all right.
They'll be fine.
The team I worry for down there is Burnley.
I worry a lot because the thing that was keeping them up last season was their defensive record, and they are shipping goals.
Yeah, they're sinking like a stone, and they're playing Spurs next weekend. Doesn't get any easier for them.
Anything else took your eye this weekend?
Well, I just wanted to raise one thing slightly different about the Chelsea contract situation, because you've got David Luiz, who was outstanding against City, but he's 30 years old, a bit like Cesc Fabregas. And Chelsea's policy these days is not giving contracts more than 1 year or a 1 year extension to players that are 30 or over. So where does that live? I mean, going into the final 6 months of his contract now,
could negotiate with European clubs.
Where does that leave him? Yeah, exactly. And Fabregas has also been linked with some moves back to Spain and in Italy as well.
I would really love to see Fabregas back at Arsenal. Having him as an option in that midfield would be very handy, especially on a free transfer.
Would he be welcome back at Arsenal then?
I think so, because Arsenal had the first option when he left Barcelona and they said no. So I think he really wanted to go back to Arsenal.
It'd be strange to sell Ramsey and bring in Fabregas though, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would be. I also wonder what the situation is going to be like. I don't want to talk about Arsenal too much because we spoke about them loads last week, but there's a few little rumours about Mesut Ozil might be getting shipped.
I could see that happening.
And I do wonder whether Arsenal may be changing their stance a little bit and maybe cashing in on Ozil for a lower fee that they probably would have hoped, and maybe re-signing Ramsey.
There seems to be a lot of clubs that take this approach now with players that are over 30. And it's not like players, especially as physiotherapy and training improves, players can go on for longer. And there's a real market there, I think, for a coach like a Sam Allardyce, Bolton era to come in and sweep up all these washed up 30-year-olds and turn them into a good team. But
the problem is what you can afford. So David Luiz's challenge is he's 30, but there's only a limited number of clubs he can go to.
Yeah.
What are his strengths? Playing out, actually, to be honest, he's defensively very strong. It's just a concentration thing with him in big games every now and again. But fundamentally, he plays out from the back extremely well. He defends one-on-one extremely well. We saw that 2012 Champions League final. He's a great asset, but there's just a limited number of clubs that can afford to give a player like that a long-term contract.
I just think, though, that someone like Cesc Fabregas, Chelsea are better off holding on to him and maybe even reinstating him into the team, given the Jorginho struggled recently, and just mixing it up a bit and showing that Chelsea do have like this plan B, because even though they beat City and they deservedly won that game, they were outplayed for much, not outplayed, but they were definitely second best for a lot of that first half. Kante popped up and scored a goal, having been guilty of giving the ball away constantly for 44 minutes and not really being at his best. And I think they're not lucky. They weren't lucky to win, but it kind of papers over the cracks a little bit. Mm. And I'd be interested to see whether they come, you know, they're going to be as strong next week.
Can I just throw out what I would like to see happen? David Luiz at Betis.
Ooh. Okay, then if we're playing this game.
David Luiz, Mark Bartra, centre back pairing.
Ooh. If we're playing this game, I want to see Fabregas go to Inter Milan and lead them over Juventus in Serie A next season. I want that to happen. I want him to play the same role for Inter that Pjanic plays for Juventus, the deep-lying midfielder surrounded by, you know, aggressive, high-press midfielders and just running things in the back of midfield. I'd love to see him do that because I think he deserves a starting spot at this point of his career.
Mm. Other news, Copa Libertadores is done.
Finally.
They finished it.
Oh, my goodness.
When did that start? Weeks ago.
3 weeks ago, the first leg was, right?
I don't want to sound awful, but the amount of novels that is going to spawn now.
Yeah.
There are literally football writers who are going to make their name off that. Not even the ones who are out there now, but it's such an epic football story. It is actually such a great story. And the final game, I mean, the football itself, the 3-1.
What a game.
Well, can I just say, anyone who just saw the goals from that game would think, wow, this game is amazing. The quality was awful for long, long periods. But Quintero, I mean, what a goal.
To do that at that time.
I think it was the red card that really swung it River's way. But yeah, that was quite some finish.
River Plate fans will not thank me for this reference, but it actually reminded me of the goal that Juventus scored to defeat River Plate in the Intercontinental Cup. When Del Piero gets the opening wide on the flank and cracks in the top corner. And this was the same level of composure. You know, when everyone around you is just like it's the whole Kipling thing.
The thing that was great was like his role in the build-up as well.
Yeah.
That was so good. And the finish was just amazing. I mean, you know, off the bar and in. We know it makes
it's always better than it goes off the bar, isn't it? It does.
No matter where it's hit.
There's statistical proof that a goal is better when it comes off the crossbar. There's actual research.
Yeah.
MIT, so great, MIT research.
Adam Hurry, Football Cliches, wrote a great tweet afterwards saying that he would love to see the XG on that third goal. 13 yards out, you know. The pocket keeper was out basically with 5-6 minutes to go.
Yeah.
He was essentially playing as like a deep-lying playmaker. Yeah. And it was just like watching a game of FIFA online with someone who's really, really great. The keeper was like running out past the centre backs, past the River Plate.
It actually was just like a game of FIFA when that keeper came. He was like he chested the ball down on the edge of his own box, and I just thought, okay, well, he's just going to pass it now.
And
he ran.
I actually shouted at one point. I was like, all the way.
Yeah.
Can I actually throw this out there? It'd be interesting for Opta or whoever to do a statistical breakdown of goals that get run into an empty net at the end of matches. Because that's definitely something I think that's changed. In the last, like, in the 70s, it never happened because a keeper stayed on the line. Mm. Like, the concept of a goalkeeper being comfortable enough with their feet and in an attacking context to actually be able to do damage in the box is such a new thing. Like, so you saw in the final, Eintracht Frankfurt against Bayern in the German Cup final last season. You saw, I think, Rebic running the ball into an empty net. I think it was Rebic.
Yeah, Neuer's got previous for this. I mean, he did it in the World Cup as well. That was an amazing thing against, what game was it? Was it South Korea game where Neuer was essentially playing a number 10 at one point.
Yeah.
But it happens so much more now. It happens so much more the last 2 decades than ever before.
Great atmosphere at the game as well on the weekend.
Messi was there. Griezmann was there.
Jordi Alba was there.
Griezmann's everywhere.
Load of the...
Godin was there.
Dybala and load of the Juve lot were there.
Shout out, actually.
Simeone was there.
While we're on the Atletico Madrid attack very briefly, they are just creeping up on the outside rail. 3 points off Barca. They're so sneaky. 3-0 over Alaves. Sneaky Atletico.
Not the best game in La Liga this weekend, though, which was Eibar Levante 4-4. If you haven't watched that game, please go and watch it. It was great fun.
They're doing the Lord's work.
But I think, quick shout for Sassuolo Fiorentina, which was very, 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 very fun. 3-1 Sassuolo. 3 red cards, I think.
Oh my goodness.
And Fiorentina clawed their way back, and who other than Kevin Morales to score the 97th minute equaliser for Fiorentina. Great game.
Right.
Right, we're almost done for this week. You may notice it's just me in the studio. The other two have long gone, so you're stuck with the lesser of the three hosts. We had hoped to be joined by a guest to round off the show this week to discuss the Women's World Cup draw that took place over the weekend. Unfortunately, our guest couldn't make it. We couldn't get our times right. So the draw took place over the weekend, and it's worth checking out fifa.com/Women's World Cup for all the info. You can see all the groups. Personally, my favourite of the groups is Group E, which is Canada, Cameroon, New Zealand and Netherlands. That kind of looks like a little bit of a group of death. England were drawn in Group D with Scotland, Argentina and Japan. For the full draw, make sure you check out the website. And also, tickets are now available to buy for the World Cup next year in France. So anyone fancy going, I think they're available through the website as well. And a quick shout as well. We were hoping also to discuss Ada Hegerberg winning the first ever women's Ballon d'Or last week in France. Ada, striker for Lyon, only 23 years old and is just 10 goals off the all-time Women's Champions League goal-scoring record already. An incredible footballer. Also, it's worth checking out The Guardian have just posted their top 100 women's footballers for 2018. That's on their website, the full list, and it's well worth a read. And also, before we go, quick bit of admin. We'd just like to give this a shout out every couple of weeks. Our theme music is by Dabry. It's a track called Bloop. We always post the Bandcamp link in the description on the website, so make sure you go check that out. Check his music. Buy it if you are into it. And also, anyone who listens on iTunes, feel free, please, to give us a review or a rating. It really helps us kind of grow the podcast at the moment. And in the words of Musa, tell a friend, tell an enemy. And that's about it for this week. So thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. And until then, take care and see you later. Bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.